DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, cracking the monsoon source code in India with the help of a brand new supercomputer. Europe muscles in on NASA's parade with a load of vital sensors on the Mars probe, while elsewhere in space the sun heats up for what could be 2 years of catastrophic coronal mass ejections. That's solar storms to you and me. And...
so that is the actual sound of the RS4 that was pre-recorded for a customer to actually experience without the car actually being here or being test-driven.
It's bonkers, and it's the most high-tech car showroom you're ever likely to experience in the next half hour or so on radio. That's Spectrum, right here and right now. But first, farmers across the agricultural belt of western Tamil Nadu and northern India do not have it easy. That's fair to say. Farming in India, an industry that half the country depends on economically, is notoriously hard and has a reputation for forcing many into desperation and suicide. This year, the fields are cracking up because the monsoon showers have been few and far between, and now drought looms large. But Indian scientists are working with colleagues from the US and Britain to build new computer models that will allow them to predict the movements of erratic monsoons weeks in advance. They say supercomputers will help them crack the monsoon source code. Murali Krishnan reports from New Delhi.
Devashish Sarkar, a small-time farmer, looks forlorn as he surveys his 3 acres of mustard and rice fields. Every now and then, he looks up to the skies, hoping they will open up, as without the much-needed rains, he knows his crop will almost certainly fail. Small landowners like Sarkar are totally dependent on the monsoons to sow their fields. Erratic monsoon can put their lives in jeopardy.
Even this year, it looks as if there are going to be no rains. Till July, rains have been scarce. This time too, the villages are bound to suffer. All my fields are going to be destroyed. It's a major loss.
To address the problem, India's Institute of Tropical Meteorology, based in the western city of Pune, is working on a multi-million dollar national monsoon mission. The project aims to forecast extreme climate events, such as drought and floods, active and dry spells of monsoon, and more importantly, collect data on how rain will fall across the country. If successful, it could drastically improve the economic prospects for about 600 million people in India, whose lives depend directly on the agricultural sector. Dr. M. Rajivan, an advisor to the Ministry of Earth Sciences, is overseeing the project.
Farming community needs forecasting.
The farming community needs longer forecasts than the medium range. That means forecasts from 7 days to a range of 1 month. These forecasts aren't being generated at the moment, but we expect that with this monsoon mission, we will do a better job.
We'll be able to do a better job.
The National Monsoon Mission has started using a dynamic model of prediction, which was developed by the US-based National Centers for Environmental Prediction. The dynamic model involves using supercomputers to compare land and sea surface, temperature data, wind speeds, and air pressure from the past 50 years to predict the monsoons. Up until now, the Indian Meteorological Department, or IMD, has used a statistical model. S.C. Bahn, the IMD's Deputy Director General, says statistical analysis is still accurate for long-range forecasts.
The forecast beyond medium time scales will be better, and the farmers will be able to make use of those information in terms of planning their seasonal aspects of different crops, what to sow, when to sow, how much proportions under different crops, and also in the medium time scales for taking tactical decisions, when to irrigate, how much to irrigate, and whether some pesticides and fertilizers are to be applied or not. That will help them bring down the cost of cultivation to a great extent.
But the new model will benefit the country's agricultural class in the short to medium term. The move is being closely watched by the agricultural sector. After all, it employs half the country's workforce. P.K. Basu, India's former agricultural secretary, who retired a few months ago, says it's critical.
I think it is very critical, extremely critical, for 2-3 reasons. One is that India feeds 17% of the world population with its 1.2 billion population. with just 4.3 of the water that the world gets. So we have a huge task on our hands, and any mistake that we make on the monsoon is extremely costly, as we have seen in the past in 2002 and 2009. And any improvement in the forecasting and prediction would be a great help in stabilizing food production in the country.
But these are early days. A lot will depend on how the government utilizes the new data. While it will be an advantage to know when the rains will fall, the government will also have to ensure farmers get the right crop varieties, and that on time. P.K. Basu again.
Where we are still deficient is the time period of about, say, 10 to 15 days. If somehow this mission can give us that kind of information 15 days ahead, it will help the farmers plan sowing, plan other agriculture activities very well. And I believe it is going on track. And I was assured by the IMD and the Earth Sciences Ministry that they are working on this problem very seriously.
In the past 130 years, the IMD has never been able to forecast a drought. Not in 1987, 2002, 2004 or 2009. Each time, it predicted normal or near normal rainfall. In the past 12 years, the closest the IMD has come to a correct forecast was in 2005, when it predicted 98% rainfall, and the actual level was 98.8%. Its worst prediction was in 2002, when it forecast 101% rainfall, and the country only received 79.4%. So do farmers like Sarkar have faith in this new national monsoon mission?
Who knows what next year brings? Let's at least hope we have good rains.
This year, the government has banked on a normal monsoon to boost weak economic growth. But so far, the reality has once again fallen short of everyone's expectations. For DW, this is Murali Krishnan in New Delhi.
NASA's Mars landing last week was a first in many ways and an extraordinary step forward for space exploration. But the US isn't the only country with hardware on Mars. Despite budgetary obstacles, which the Americans, of course, also face, European technology and aerospace programs are blazing ahead themselves. Many have found their way onto the rover Curiosity and are getting in some hard graft on the red planet as we speak. Holly Cooper reports.
The successful landing of NASA's Mars probe, Curiosity, is very much an American achievement. With every new image we receive from the rover, we are reminded that NASA has gone where Europe's Beagle 2 failed in 2003. But as with so much in space exploration, Curiosity is also an international affair, with European space scientists taking the landing as fresh inspiration for their own efforts to get to Mars. Some are already there, courtesy of Curiosity. Like the German company Sensitech, which makes magneto-resistive sensor technology. Its sensors are all over the rover.
Our sensors are used on pretty well everything that moves on Curiosity. So the wheels, the steering, the mast that carries the camera to make pictures, also the robot arm to do some scientific work on Mars. In all these, if you like, parts of the rover, you need to measure position. And for that, you need sensors, and they come from us.
That was Sensitech's managing director, Dr. Rolf Slatter. The company's sensors use the magneto-resistive effect, or the MR effect. It's been around for 150 years, but has only been used in sensors for the last 30, opening up new application fields in magnetic field measurement. Slatter says Sensitech has virtually cornered the market.
So there's a bit of Hessen and Ryan flown with Curiosity. It's now sitting on Mars, and it's joining some of the sensors we sent up with Spirit and Opportunity. So we're actually already on Mars now, so we've got like 100% market share on Mars, which is quite fun.
Fun, but also nerve-wracking. The sensors had to withstand the entire journey and the precarious landing on Mars. That's not to mention the harsh atmosphere and climate of the planet now that it's there. MR sensors are resistant to dust, oil, and humidity, and can endure severe temperature changes. They consume low levels of energy, and perhaps most importantly, they are resistant to cosmic or nuclear radiation. U.S.-based sensor technology company FuTech has also contributed several sensors to the rover. In fact, Curiosity is covered in all kinds of international fingerprints, a reminder that complicated space exploration requires contributions from many nations. Bernard L. von Veja, who is part of ESA's communication team, highlighted this collaboration.
There are Europeans involved. You have the Spanish Institute for Astrobiology in Madrid involved. You have a German Aerospace Center, DLR, and the University of Kiel involved as well from Germany. You have two science teams from CNES France involved, and also you have Russian scientists involved.
But sometimes collaboration fails. Earlier this year, NASA pulled the plug on its involvement in Europe's ExoMars program. It cited budgetary cuts. Now that Curiosity has landed on the red planet, ESA hopes the success will encourage new funding for European Mars exploration. In November, ministers from the 19 countries that make up the European Space Agency meet in Caserta, Italy, to agree on the next few years of space programs. That includes ExoMars, which has yet to get the green light. The intended ExoMars program is comprised of two missions to Mars, both which will search for evidence of past or present microbial life. One is a trace gas orbiter to be launched in 2016. It would analyze gases like methane and act as a relay to the second mission, a rover, launched 2 years later. Mark McCochrane is ESA's head of research and science support.
We're actually doing something beyond what Curiosity is. Each time we put new missions onto the surface, we aim to go further. And so what we'll be doing with our 18 rover, which Curiosity can't, is digging below the surface. I think, you know, it would be going too far to looking for active life at depths of just 2 meters. But we could hope to find signs of life in the past, and certainly understanding habitability better.
And all of that would lead to the next step, the thing that most scientists desire, to land people on Mars.
Holly Cooper with that report there. Well, we've heard a lot of congratulatory news from space over the past week, but where there's boom, there's most often also gloom, because scientists have been reminding us that there's a heightened risk over the next 2 years that a massive solar storm could knock out power grids, satellites and other forms of communication here on Earth. The Sun is heading for the end of what's generally considered a 10 or 11-year active cycle, a point at which the risk of coronal mass ejections grows massively. Basically, the Sun throws out huge tentacles of magnetically charged plasma when magnetic structures on the Sun break down. Professor Mike Hapgood, a space weather specialist at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in the UK, told me there can be a lack of awareness of the risks.
We know that the activity that we see on the Sun's surface waxes and wanes over a cycle of roughly 11 years. But we know that, you know, the numbers of sunspots increases and decreases with that cycle, and we can now, you know, from records we've traced that back to the time of Galileo. So we know a lot about the sunspot numbers.
And what are the sunspots?
The sunspots are just regions of the Sun's surface where there's a strong magnetic field emerging from inside the Sun. Because there's a magnetic field there, it allows the heat to escape more easily, and therefore it's a bit cooler. It's only 4,000 degrees. Rather than 6,000 degrees as it is on the rest of the Sun's surface. They're both hot, but because of that difference in temperature, the sunspots appear darker. They're not as bright.
And at what point do the solar storms, the solar flares, come into play here? Because, I mean, you know, these images, of course, they're absolutely ferocious. Mm. What's happening there?
Well, when we actually go into space and look at the Sun at different wavelengths, picking the ultraviolet and X-rays, we see an awful lot more detail, and we can see how the magnetic fields are emerging from the Sun. They fill the Sun's atmosphere, the corona, you know, and there are regions of very hot trapped gas at temperatures of tens of thousands or even up to a million degrees. And you see there's all these wonderful structures of plasma held in place by magnetic fields. But sometimes those magnetic structures break down, and we've now got wonderful movies where you see there's one of these structures, it appears a bit dark compared to the Sun, and it just gently flies away from the Sun. And that leads to what we call a coronal mass ejection. The coronal mass ejection, these huge clouds of hot gas, that's what really matters.
And it's this hot gas that travels through space and can engulf the Earth. Mm. What are the dangers and the negative effects that it can have to satellites, etc.?
Where the danger comes is when they interact with the Earth's magnetic field. And if energy from this coronal mass ejection enters the Earth's magnetic field, then there's all sorts of processes within the Earth's magnetic field, what we call the magnetosphere, that can focus the energy down. If you think the magnetosphere is 100 times the area of the cross-sectional area of the Earth. So it's collecting an awful lot of energy and then focusing down in particular regions around the Earth, and particularly in the polar regions of the upper atmosphere. And that's where some of that energy will appear as the northern lights. And so we get those wonderful displays. But at the same time as we see that, there's a lot of energy being heating the upper atmosphere. It changes all the winds in the upper atmosphere, and this has sort of bad effects on things like radio communications. It affects the drag on spacecraft in low Earth orbits. Most importantly, all these things drive electric currents in the space around the Earth and in the upper atmosphere. And that's what gives us the idea of a magnetic storm. Those currents, we can see them on the ground as changes in the magnetic field. The compass needle may be changing direction a few degrees. Sensitive instruments can measure very detailed changes.
But can we expect really mass dropouts or fallouts in the next 2 years when this reaches the end or really gets to the pinnacle? I mean, if we think about 1989 in Quebec, a magnetic storm is blamed for having knocked out the entire power grid there. And if we think about what happened to India just recently, I mean, that's just disastrous, isn't it? Is that what we're heading for?
Certainly in the UK and the US now, if we had a really the worst case, somewhat stronger than 1989, in fact, on the scale of what we think happened in 1921 when a telephone exchange in Sweden burnt down because of a magnetic storm, something on that size, there's a concern it would knock out the power grid. The power would collapse. It wouldn't damage very much equipment, but it would upset the grid so much that it would automatically switch off, and then it would take 1 or 2 days to restore the power to most people, longer for a few people. Some people could be a few months, but only a small proportion.
But despite this, you said that while some governments are taking the threat seriously, others are in a state of denial.
No. I don't think there was any governments in doing that. I think the...
But some people are in denial, right? That's what you said, that there is some denial out there.
Not really. I think it's more a case of lack of awareness. I think one of the things we're gradually making progress with is we're beginning to realize these things can creep down. Certainly very worried about it throughout the UK. And I think there is some growing awareness in other European countries that it's an issue we have to think about. It's not something to be scared of. The thing to be scared of is not thinking about it.
So we have to think about it. What can we actually do about it?
I think one thing is when power companies buy new transformers, this is, I know, has happened a lot in say, Sweden, Britain, and in the US, they improve the specification of transformers, so you buy better transformers that can resist this better. You also, I think, now having contingency plans of how you operate the grid when there's a warning, that you make sure that you have plenty of reserve power generators available to try and keep the grid running, that you make sure all the grid lines are running. We can start to sense about a week ahead that there may be a risk. You start to see activity appearing on the sun, rotating into view on what we call the east side of the sun. And you can see that there's a potential problem. So at that point, you begin to start watching more carefully.
Professor Mike Hapgood of the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in the UK there. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW in Bonn. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us at dw_SciTech. Now, every year in Germany, around 2,000 children and other young people are diagnosed with cancer. It's a shock for everyone, of course, not least because cancer is totally unpredictable in the young, and the treatment they have to endure is intense and exhausting. 8-year-old Julian Klapsing's condition first emerged when he started having pain in his stomach. It took a series of tests before he was finally diagnosed with lymph node cancer. And our reporter Greta Harman has visited him at his home and found out that cancer in children is not always the same as cancer in adults. Andreas Grigor has her report.
From the carpet to the wallpaper, window ornaments, books and the blanket cover, Julian's room is the perfect place for anyone who loves tractors. Dozens of miniature tractor models are parked neatly on the floor. Tractors, tractors, and more tractors of different brands. Julian knows them all.
John Deere.
Julian recently even visited the place where his favorite tractor is manufactured, at the Klaas company. Together with his best friend Felix and his father, Julian had a whole day to marvel at the latest models of these giant tractors. It was an adventure that 2 months ago would have been impossible. Julian was still receiving chemotherapy, and there was a lot that he wasn't allowed to do, says his mother.
No going to the movies or the public pool, no ice cream from the ice cream shop, no raspberries, no strawberries, no cherries, no riding along on the tractor with Dad. A number of things he couldn't do.
The chemotherapy has greatly weakened Julian's immune system. Besides not being able to eat a number of things, he has to be especially careful when he comes in contact with other people.
I'm a word of Papa and I'm not by...
Talking with his younger sister, they remember how she was ill and their dad had to take care of her.
Dann hatte ich Grippe.
Ja, weil dann durfte Papa nämlich nicht da bleiben.
As a consequence, Julian's dad and sister had to stay away from Julian in order not to pass on the germs. In addition to his weakened immune system, Julian has had to face a range of other side effects. He has lost his hair, he often suffers from nausea and he's had sore spots in his mouth. They're all side effects of his medication. The side effects may be extreme because children tend to receive cancer treatments which are a lot more intense than those of adults. But the bodies of children can deal with the medication more easily, and it often means the therapy is a lot more successful. Almost 85% of all children and young adults overcome the cancer and later lead a healthy, normal life, which is not always the case with adults. But while with adults it's often external factors that cause the cancer, such as wrong diet, stress or smoking, that tends not to be the case with children. Heribert Jürgens heads the polyclinic at the Münster University Hospital. Julian is one of his patients.
Cancer with children is strongly connected to a core feature within young people. They grow and they develop, and this means frequent cell division. And within this process, there's always the risk of something going wrong.
This is why cancer in children often grows within the part of the body that develops the most rapidly, the immune system. And this immune system consists largely of lymph nodes. Almost half of all young people who develop the illness therefore either have lymph node cancer or leukemia, which is cancer of the blood. Lymph node cancer, as in Julian's case, is hard to detect. In many cases, indicators may be little knots that form around the lymph nodes, but if the cancer grows in a less obvious place, few doctors think of it right away. Julian underwent a number of tests and examinations before his doctors knew that it was a tumor that was causing his stomach aches. His parents were in shock.
It's like someone pulling the rug away from under your feet, and there's nothing you can do. It makes you completely helpless. You know they are pumping an incredible amount of chemicals into the body of your child, and you have to sit there and watch him suffer.
And yet she knew that this was the only way for her son to have a chance of survival. Julian, meanwhile, only learned what the excitement was all about a lot later.
I guess children just don't give it that much thought. Had I told Julian that they'd have to remove his appendix or his tonsils, to him, that would have been the same. And it took quite a long time before he asked me if it was possible that he could die.
Julian still has to stop by at the hospital once a week for checkups. But the worst is behind him, and he can focus on the future again. In fact, he already knows what he wants to do for a living, and that, of course, includes tractors.
Andreas Gregor with that report by Greta Harman.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
It's been a while since a car was simply an object made of metal and glass and bits of plastic and rubber. Brand advertising has transformed cars, of course, into experiences, dreams and desires. Automation, as the carmaker Seat puts it. Or in the words of Seat's parent company, Volkswagen, aus Liebe zum Automobil, out of love for the car. Another Volkswagen subsidiary, Audi, hopes to take the idea of brand loyalty a step further, however, by opening up as many as 20 so-called Audi City showrooms in major urban centres around the world. High-tech spaces they are that enable customers to get interactive with their cars as they choose which one to buy. The thing is, most of the cars aren't actually there. The first Audi City was opened in London, and Robin Powell has been to have a look.
We call it Audi City Power Wall. It has a camera on top, and Michelle is locking herself onto the wall right now.
Audi's new showroom in the heart of London looks like no other car dealership in the world. In fact, it wouldn't be out of place at a computing or electronics convention. Four large touchscreen tables stand where display cars might normally be, and each device is linked to an enormous television screen equipped with a Kinect-type camera system.
Now, it's created a small avatar of her.
OK, so I can see the small figure at the bottom of the screen now is mimicking where Michelle's standing.
Exactly.
And a series of models of Audis appeared on the screen, and according to where she stands, it selects a certain model. Is that
definitely
right?
Definitely. She's going to walk across and choose the RS4 event.
As I step onto the round arrow, it would rotate the car for you, and on the right-hand side, you can see all the technologies that we have within the car.
The four power walls, each measuring 2.5 metres high by 4.5 metres wide, are the centrepiece of Audi's new approach to selling cars. Customers can select any vehicle from the Audi range, in any colour and trim, and see it from any angle. Or even hear the sound of the engine as it goes on a virtual test drive.
Just wait a few seconds and then the drive-off scene would pop up. So that is the actual sound of the RS4 that was pre-recorded for a customer to actually experience without the car actually being here or being test-driven.
Being able to customise car colours and styles before ordering your vehicle is nothing new. These days you can do it on most car makers' websites, at the budget or luxury end of the market. But Dominic Chambers, the head of marketing for Audi UK, believes his high-tech showroom has an extra allure.
The audio-visual here is way in advance of anyone's home setup. So you can see the car in full size, which you cannot do at home. And also you have the sounds and potentially the smells here as well with the leathers. So I think there's a much deeper engagement into the brand and into the cars that they would not be able to get at home.
Back upstairs, a chat with a couple of customers suggests that Audi City is an improvement on the average showroom experience.
It can be quite intimidating going into a car showroom sometimes, and the more you can explore actually what a car's capable of doing and see what it looks like, the more likely you are, I think, to consider it as a car. Whether you'd actually buy a 90 grand car because of it or not is another matter.
If you come into the showroom and you're at a point where a tipping point for buying anyway, I think this kind of thing will help the emotional connection to the car anyway. I think it could help tip you over the edge.
Paul Edwards, Europe CEO for international brand consultancy Hall & Partners, confirms that interaction with a brand is the key to selling cars.
A lot of buying a car brand is justifying it afterwards. The brands spend a lot of money making you desire them and really want them. And then you've got to defend that down the pub, down the golf club, wherever it is. So you've got to go along armed with, you know, the torque, with the brake horsepower, with all that sort of stuff. And if you can give the impression that you contributed to putting together this rather superior Audi, then, you know, you've given yourself great golf club ammo.
Music to the ears of Audi, I'm sure. But you can't help feeling there's something missing here. Audi City London only has room for 3 display models. Customers can arrange a test drive, but are big screens really a substitute for sitting in the car you might actually buy? Not to mention the fact that Audi will have to keep up with advances in touchscreen and motion sensing technology if the Audi City concept, that has already cost the firm over 10 million euros, is to avoid looking outdated. Here's Chambers again.
Well, look, technology does move on at a pace, you're right, but there's nothing like this anywhere else in the world. It's absolutely unique at the moment. I mean, will it be unique in 2 years? Maybe not, but, you know, we're making an investment here. We are going to obviously monitor it as a pilot, and I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we may have to improve and upgrade the technology as we go forward.
Audi isn't the only premium car brand to have a showroom in central London. Down the road, there's Porsche, there's Land Rover, there's BMW Mini near Hyde Park. Will the idea catch on? As a measure perhaps of uncertain economic times, Audi could only confirm that one more Audi City will definitely go ahead in Beijing later this year. Robin Powell for DW, Audi City, London.
Well, would you buy a second-hand car? No, only joking. Anyway, that is all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikara Bani. Our studio tech was Jürgen Kuhn. Coming up soon on Spectrum, the dark side of gaming. Hope you can make it then. Thanks for listening and bye for now.